Thanks so much for staying with us.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Pariskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajeem. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Mathalu alladhina yunfiquna amwalahum fi sabilillah كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of a grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every year. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Taliban militants tighten the noose around the Afghan capital Kabul as the UN chief says Afghanistan is spinning out of control. The US and a host of European countries deploy thousands of troops to help evacuate their diplomats and nationals from Afghanistan. Also ahead, immigration advocates censure the U.S. president's asylum policies, describing the expulsion of migrants at the Mexican border as cruel and unlawful. Thank you for joining us. Our top story, the Taliban have tightened their territorial stranglehold around the Afghan capital Kabul as they expand their control across the country. Taliban militants are now camped just 50 kilometers away from Kabul, fueling fears of an assault on the city. Kabul is the last stand for government forces as well as thousands of Afghan refugees who flooded the city following the Taliban's advances across the country. The group has accelerated its offensive in recent days, capturing 18 provincial capitals, including Kandahar and Herat. It is estimated that they are now in control of nearly two-thirds of the country. The US and a host of European countries have begun deploying thousands of troops to help evacuate their diplomats and nationals from Afghanistan.
Expect that by the end of the weekend, the bulk of the 3,000 that we talked about yesterday will be in place. Probably not all, but the bulk. What we want to be able to do is to get there fast and get there capable and be able to provide as much capacity to the State Department as we can. And our intention is to be able to move thousands per day.
The Pentagon said its forces will be ready to airlift American nationals from Kabul if needed. The UK government also said a military operation is launched to help evacuate British nationals, urging them to leave the country immediately. And the United Nations Secretary General has called on Taliban militants to immediately halt their offensive in Afghanistan.
I call on the Taliban to immediately halt the offensive and to negotiate in good faith in the interest of Afghanistan and its people. I hope that discussions in Doha, Qatar, between representatives of the Islamic Republic of Afghanistan and the Taliban, supported by the region and the wider international community, will restore the best way to a negotiated settlement to the conflict.
Antonio Guterres warned that Afghanistan is spinning out of control. He told the reporters that seizing power through military force is a losing proposition that can only lead to prolonged civil war. Guterres expressed concern over early indications that the Taliban are imposing severe restrictions on human rights in the areas under their control. The UN chief called on all parties to do more to protect civilians. The United States has imposed sanctions on an Omani national and several companies that Washington says are linked to Iran. The U.S. Treasury Department described the individual as an oil smuggler. It has also targeted four firms, two based in Oman, one in Liberia, and another in Romania, citing their alleged support for Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. The measures freeze all the assets the people and firms have in the U.S. and bar American companies from doing business with them. Tim Anderson, the director of the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies, says the United States' economic sanctions against Iran amount to economic warfare aimed at pressuring the Iranian nation into submission.
This is not sanctions. These are economic warfare measures. They are attempts to place tens of millions of people in the entire West Asian region under siege until they surrender. And they're illegal for three reasons. The first is they attempt to coerce political change across the region. They aim to hurt entire populations. And they hurt third parties as well. So regimes like the ones in Europe that don't have the independence to act against the US will pay fines for them doing business with people there. But it is really siege warfare, and we should call it what it is. In the short term, they will hurt people. And that is what the US wants to do at the moment. It wants to punish the populations that have successfully resisted the various wars of the so-called New Middle East. They attempt to dissuade people from joining in with the resistance networks. And I think it's pretty clear that they're failing, but they're going to hurt people, no doubt.
Immigration advocates have slammed the U.S. president for his administration's expulsion of migrants at the Mexico border and other deterrent measures. In a letter to Joe Biden, more than 100 organizations said the measures are, quote, cruel, unlawful, and ineffective. They called on the president to restore all migrants' ability to claim asylum in the U.S. and to avoid imposing any limits on asylum access. They said the Biden administration is apparently focused only on arrests and deportations and not the rights of asylum seekers. The advocates noted that Biden's policy absolutely contradicts his pledges of a humane approach to the matter. The U.S. president has adhered to his predecessor's policy of sending migrants caught crossing the border back to Mexico. This has pushed the border arrests up to 20-year highs in recent months. Political commentator Barry Grossman says U.S. Democrats who have been highly critical of the Trump administration regarding the immigrants are now following the same policy.
I think most people have recognized for many years now that campaign promises are really just a marketing exercise to get people to cast their vote in favor of the candidate, and that there's no ensuing obligation on the part of the candidate to then implement those policies. When it comes to immigration, I mean, it was very interesting how Democrats were highly critical of Trump's policy on immigration, but the fact is that Democrats have embraced exactly the same policies on immigration for many years. When we look at what's happening now, what we see essentially is the U.S. bureaucracy encouraged by the executive, but certainly not dependent on the executive, misusing existing laws in order to turn people away at the border. They've long restricted access to the ability of individuals to apply for asylum at the border.
The U.S. Department of Homeland Security has issued a new terrorism threat advisory. In its bulletin, the department has warned that the U.S. faces threats from domestic and foreign terrorists. The department says fresh COVID-19 restrictions to contain the spread of the Delta variant could spark violent attacks by extremists. According to the department, pandemic-related issues may provoke more violence this year. The department has also sounded the alarm about possible terrorist activities around the 20th anniversary of the September 11 attacks. It said New York and Washington could be subject to what it called targeted violence by U.S.-based individuals inspired from abroad. The United States has imposed fresh sanctions against Cuba, citing alleged human rights abuses. The U.S. Treasury Department added two Cuban Ministry of Interior officials and a unit of the Cuban Ministry of Revolutionary Armed Forces to its sanctions blacklist. That's the third round of U.S. measures against Cuba over the government's response to protests that took place on the island in July. Meanwhile, Cuba's Foreign Minister Bruno Rodriguez on Twitter rejected the sanctions, saying they are a sign of Washington's double standards policy.
I reject the U.S. opportunistic measures against Cuba's Ministry of Interior officers and Armed Forces prevention troops. Such measures reflect double standards of a government used to manipulation and lies to maintain the blockade against Cuba.
Rodriguez had previously denounced the protests as, quote, systemic provocation by U.S.-backed dissidents. Cuba was the scene of anti-government protests on July 11th and 12th. Over an ongoing economic crisis. Havana blames Washington's decades-long economic pressure as well as COVID-19 pandemic for the economic downturn. China has once again rejected calls for a further investigation into the origins of the novel coronavirus. Beijing says the demands for a new probe are politically motivated. Earlier, we discussed the issue in our news review program.
On this segment of the program, China has rejected the World Health Organization's calls for a renewed probe into the origins of COVID-19. Beijing says the calls are politically motivated. On Thursday, the WHO urged China to share raw data from the earliest COVID cases to revive its probe into the origins of the disease. The organization carried out a first investigation in January when its team visited the Chinese city of Wuhan. That's where the first global infections emerged. In its report, the WHO said it was, quote, extremely unlikely that a lab leak caused the pandemic, but it failed to conclude how the virus began. Now China says that same report should be the basis of a future global traceability work. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have Peter Koenig, author and lecturer, joining us from Geneva. Also, political analyst John Bosnich is joining us from Belgrade. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Koenig in Geneva. What are your thoughts on China's rejection of the recent demands by the World Health Organization?
Great, thank you very much for having me. China is absolutely right. WHO had their day in court, so to speak, in January this year. They came to their conclusions pretty much to what China said from the beginning, that the virus didn't originate in China. Well, it was reported that there were no conclusion, in fact, but that's basically what they agreed when they left China. But the West is not happy. In order to continue demonizing China, the West would like WHO's authority to say the contrary. Mind you, you know who are the key financiers of WHO other than the member countries. Let's say outside sources, so-called extra-budgetary funding is about 3 to 4 times higher than the regular WHO budget, which consists basically from member countries' contributions. Among the outside funders are the most prominent ones, the Gates Foundation, GAVI, which stands for Global Alliance for Global Alliance for Vaccines and Immunization, which was also created by Bill Gates, and which, by the way, is housed just next door to WHO in Geneva, and other pharmaceuticals and supporters of Big Pharma. Of course, they are all not contributing directly to WHO, but in the form, in the indirect form, I would say, of trust fund financing modes, so it is less recognizable. It is also clear, as it has been since the beginning, that the coronavirus was a laboratory-made virus. There are several patents available, but you won't find them anymore on the internet, as the fake fact checkers had removed them all. Given this background, it is obvious that the West needs, number one, somebody else to blame, and number two, especially China. China is a menace for the West, an imagined menace, let's face it, but imagined anyway, because the West, led by the US, is in an economic decline, and with it, the supremacy of the Western world, so far maintained by the US dollar, which is a fiat currency dominance, and militarily supported by NATO. It is in rapid decline, and China is in ascent. While China's currency, the yuan, is based on the country's economic strength, which is nothing fiat there.
Mr. Bosnich, your thoughts on China's rejection, and also if you'd like to add anything to what our guest in Geneva just mentioned.
Well, first of all, I would like to underline and support every single word of your other guest. These are my experiences as well. I've worked in government advising on three continents, and I can tell you that the standard purpose for international investigations is to falsely point a finger at a guilty party who can then be sanctioned, punished, or in other ways, demonized. Especially since this effort is aimed at China, we can deduce that the objective is to demonize China and to blame China for a virus. Now, living all of us as we do on one planet where human beings get viruses and transmit viruses to each other, the idea of blaming a country for a virus is inhuman in itself, which would actually lead us back to NATO, because NATO is an inhuman organization based entirely on the flexing of military muscle. So the NATO countries and the United States private corporations, the drug dealers of the planet, are working together to try to point a finger at China to decrease China's influence in international affairs. And this incident and their demand for an investigation reminds me of the incident that the United States staged here in Serbia to try to detach Serbia's Kosovo heartland by staging an incident in Racak, calling it the Racak Massacre, inviting a CIA agent to conduct the investigation, and then say that there's a one-sided conclusion that the Serbs are guilty. The exact same thing is planned for China, and China is more than intelligent enough to say no. And to quote Nancy Reagan, just say no to globalist drugs.
All right, thank you, gentlemen. Peter Koenig joining us from Geneva. Also, thanks to political analyst John Bosnich speaking to us from Belgrade.
And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
Supplication on Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all. From the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord and Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee, and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. Oh, the most merciful.
In the limelight.
Then United States is now seeking to minimize or dismiss expert medical evidence provided by neuropsychiatrist Michael Koppelman, who last year testified that WikiLeaks whistleblower Julian Assange is autistic, suffers from recurring depression, and was likely to try to kill himself if extradited to the United States. We now present you an article written by Brett Wilkins, staff writer for Common Dreams website. Based in San Francisco, his work covers issues of social justice, human rights, and war and peace. The article is titled, Further Blow to Press Freedoms as U.S. Wins Appeal in Effort to Extradite Julian Assange. Britain's High Court on Wednesday, 11th of August, handed the United States a win in its bid to extradite Julian Assange. Press freedom and other human rights defenders renewed calls for the Biden administration to drop all charges against the WikiLeaks founder. Lord Justice Tim Holroyd on Wednesday, 11th of August, ruled that the U.S. government may expand its appeal for a lower court's rejection of the Trump administration's attempt to extradite Julian Assange. On 4th of January, Judge Vanessa Breitzer of the Westminster Magistrates Court warned that extradition would be oppressive by reasons of Assange's mental health, and that there was a substantial risk the WikiLeaks whistleblower would kill himself in a U.S. prison. Claire Dobbin, an attorney representing the U.S. government in the case, had countered that Julian Assange would be able to resist suicide in American custody. The United States is now seeking to minimize or dismiss expert medical evidence provided by the neuropsychiatrist Michael Koppelman, who last year testified that Julian Assange is autistic, suffers from recurring depression, and was likely to try to kill himself if extradited to the United States. Lord Justice Tim Holroyd said Wednesday that the High Court would hear the full appeal on 27th and 28th of October this year. Julian Assange has been imprisoned in London's notorious Belmarsh prison for over 2 years now. Speaking outside the Royal Courts of Justice in London on Wednesday, 11th of August, the former Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn told demonstrators that journalism is a very dangerous and risky profession when done properly, and that Julian Assange walks in the great tradition of great fearless journalists. Jeremy Corbyn added, "We're here to support Julian Assange and demand his freedom. Julian Assange, to me, walks in the great tradition of great fearless journalists. We're here to support Julian Assange and demand his freedom, and will be here as many times as it takes to continue making that call." Stella Morris, Julian Assange's wife, told protesters that the U.S. government is exploiting the inherently unfair extradition arrangements with this country in order to arbitrarily prolong his imprisonment. Amnesty International legal advisor Simon Crowther said outside of the courtroom that charges like those against Julian Assange should never be brought against journalists or publishers. Simon Crowther said, "What this allows the U.S. to do is to challenge journalists and editors when they publish things the U.S. does not want in the public domain, sometimes classified material, which is the lifeblood of investigative journalists when they're investigating things like war crimes and crimes against humanity that are perpetrated by states like the United States." Simon Crowther noted that This would have a very significant chilling effect if the U.S. were to win this case. Journalists would have to look over their shoulder and worry about their legal liability when they accept information from sources provided to them confidentially. While Amnesty International in a tweet on Wednesday, 11th of August, wrote, Simon Crowther, Amnesty International's legal advisor, explains why the Julian Assange case matters so much for freedom of expression and human rights, and why Amnesty International are calling on the American and the British governments to drop the charges against Julian Assange. Amnesty International on Wednesday, 11th of August, joined Assange Defense, Freedom of the Press Foundation, the International Federation of Journalists, Reporters Without Borders, and other advocacy groups that reiterated earlier calls for U.S. authorities to drop all charges against the jailed whistleblower. Niels Muisnieks, Amnesty's European director, said in a statement, this attempt by the U.S. government to get the court to reverse its decision not to allow Julian Assange's extradition on the basis of new diplomatic assurances is a blatant legal sleight of hand. Niels Muisnieks continued, this disingenuous appeal should be dismissed by the court, and President Biden should take the opportunity to drop these politically motivated charges which have put media freedom and freedom of expression in the dock. Niels Muisnieks, Amnesty International's European director, added, President Barack Obama opened the investigation into Julian Assange. President Donald Trump brought charges against him. It is now time for President Biden to do the right thing and help end this farcical prosecution, which should never have been brought in the first place. Edward Snowden, a former computer intelligence consultant who leaked highly classified information from the U.S. National Security Agency, NSA, in 2013 when he was an employee and subcontractor for the Central Intelligence Agency, CIA, on 10th of August said, the world's foremost human rights organization, Amnesty International, has issued an extremely strong statement denouncing the Biden administration's political persecution of Julian Assange, which reignites tomorrow. Julian Assange is charged in the United States with violating the 1917 Espionage Act and the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act for publishing classified U.S. military documents on WikiLeaks over a decade ago. Among the materials brought to light by Julian Assange and WikiLeaks are the so-called collateral murder video, which shows a U.S. Army helicopter crew killing a group of innocent Iraqi civilians. The Afghan war diary and the Iraq war logs, all of which reveal U.S. and allied war crimes in both Iraq and Afghanistan. Many of the documents published by WikiLeaks were provided by former U.S. Army whistleblower Chelsea Manning. Unlike Manning, who spent 7 years in prison before her sentence was commuted by Barack Obama in January of 2017, none of the soldiers or commanders implicated in war crimes by WikiLeaks were seriously punished. Julian Assange could spend the rest of his life behind bars if he is convicted of all the charges against him.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
too.
After 300 years of colonization of Indonesia, the Dutch finally had to abandon the occupied lands because that was what the people of Indonesia wanted. Dr. Ahmad Sukarno had been involved in the nationalist activities since his puberty. He then spearheaded the movement for independence from the Netherlands. In 1945, Dr. Ahmad Sukarno announced his people's demand for independence, but the Dutch were not willing to give up 3 centuries of dominance over Indonesia's resources. Therefore, the people of Indonesia had to fight with the Dutch for 4 years to achieve their independence. Historical accounts refer to the 4-year war as savage. Just one example is enough to support this claim. In 1947, in the middle of the independence war, Dutch soldiers entered the village of Rawagede and killed 341 men and male children of the village before the eyes of their families. Dutch ambassador Tir de Zouan took part in the 66th anniversary of the Rawagede massacre. He apologized to the families of the victims and said that he was not only there on behalf of his country's government, but also as a representative of the Dutch nation. After 4 years of unabated war, the United Nations finally stepped in and the Dutch government had to accept a new governmental system called the Netherlands-Indonesian Union, and the two sides signed a truce. Finally, in 1949, the two sides signed an agreement which stipulated that the entire land of Indonesia, except for New Guinea, be handed over to the interim government of the United States of Indonesia. On December 16, 1949, Dr. Ahmad Sukarno was elected as the president of the country. Contemporary cultural and societal ties between Iran and Indonesia date back to the 1960s and 70s. After years of break, the two sides resumed ties and Iran reopened its embassy in Indonesia. The resumption of diplomatic ties paved the way for the revival of trade and cultural interactions. Their Omidvar brothers might be the first Iranian tourists in Indonesia at those times. Isa and Abdullah Omidvar are Iranian world explorers who started their round-the-world expedition in the 1950s. The two brothers described as sensational the celebrations of Indonesia's independence and the 2-hour-long speech by then-President Ahmad Sukarno. The explorers said 10 years after the independence, Indonesians still would end their phone conversations with the word Merdeka, which means independence. 20 years later, in the 1950s, Iran sent a parliamentary delegation headed by then Prime Minister Sharif Emami to Indonesia to take part in the celebrations of the 30th anniversary of the country's independence. Iran's 1979 Islamic Revolution did not disrupt the two states' bilateral relations. In fact, the two sides have maintained their close ties at high levels. The presidents of the two nations exchanged official visits and signed memoranda of understanding. Most importantly, it seems that the Islamic Revolution has influenced the public in Indonesia. After the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Indonesian youth came to Iran for education and became acquainted with the Shiite school of thought. When they would return to their country, they would act as missionaries and promote this way of thinking among their people. That is why experts attribute the recent rise in the number of Shia Muslims in Indonesia to Iran. Today, Shiite Muslims account for around 5 million of the Muslim population in Indonesia. Now, what is the status of Shia Islam in modern-day Indonesia? President Abdulrahman Ar-Rahim, who succeeded General Suharto, headed the organization of Nahdlatul Ulama for a while. The organization was founded by his father. Ar-Rahim regarded himself as a cultural Shia and that he ran an organization with cultural preferences. Such a belief is still preserved by the incumbent leaders of the organization. This means that in addition to the concept of imamat, 12 imams, and other fundamental beliefs, most of the Islamic and ideological teachings in the organization follow the Shia doctrine. Most of the Sufi rituals, pilgrimages, and religious traditions practiced by religious traditionalists are mostly inclined towards Shia Islam. Whenever a person gets sick, a number of people pray for them and reach out to the five sacred members of the Prophet Muhammad's household, known as the Ahle Aba. Sunni Muslims still make vows and offer votive foods. There are written pilgrimage prayers inscribed on the tombs of the Sadat, which consist of the names of sacred figures in Shia Islam, such as that of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, Hazrat Zahra, Imam Hassan, and Imam Hussein, peace be upon them. This attests to the fact that Twelver Shia did exist in Indonesia and that Shia Islam lives on in the country. Indonesia is the most populated Muslim country. This is why it attracts significant attention from the world and Muslim countries. In addition to Iran, Saudi Arabia is also seeking to promote its ideology in Indonesia. Wahhabism, which is not congruent with the peaceful nature of the people of Indonesia. Al Saud's activities in Indonesia stretch back to the early 1970s. They launched several Salafi organizations and a number of moderate movements in Indonesia to promote the Hanbali school of jurisprudence in parallel with the Al-Shafi'i school. In the 1970s and 80s, Saudi Arabia published Wahhabi books in Indonesia with low prices. General Suharto became Indonesia's president in 1967 after he led a coup against his predecessor, Ahmad Sukarno. Besides the Indonesian graduates in Saudi Arabia, commentators believe Suharto also played an effective role in the promotion of Wahhabism in Indonesia. They founded Wahhabi centers in Indonesia, which are still operating in the country. The emergence of extremist attitudes towards the followers of other religions and denominations can be linked to efforts by Wahhabi groups in the country. In one particular incident, a leader of congressional prayer of a Wahhabi mosque ordered the expulsion of Shia Muslims and the destruction of their properties. Following this violent order, thousands of men, women, and children were forced to leave the city after their houses were burnt down. In another incident, a crowd set fire to a church while chanting Allah is great and razed it to the ground. The emergence of extremist ideologies has created discord among the people of Indonesia and has led to extremist Muslims committing acts of violence against Christians of Indonesia. However, the moral people of Indonesia do not accept such a violent way of thinking. It's the last days of the holy month of Ramadan. Eid al-Fitr is around the corner. Decorations can be seen in four corners of the city to usher in the occasion. All Muslims try their best to get the necessary items to celebrate the festivity. The city is brimming with colors, joy, and happiness. With the sighting of the new moon, the celebrations of Eid al-Fitr get started. A
Idul Fitr is the most important festivity in Indonesia. On the occasion, families dress in the same colors and head to mosques to perform Idul Fitr prayer. This harmony in dressing represents unity. After Idul Fitr prayer, it's time for family visits. On Idul Fitr, everyone is smiling. The people of Indonesia are renowned for being smiley. Here you can always see rows of white teeth, which are not willing to hide behind the lips. Hindus, Buddhists, Christians, and Shia and Sunni Muslims all live together peacefully in this green country. They enjoy their coexistence. They are used to getting together on any occasion and trying to be happy all the time. And of course, everywhere in the country, there are entertainment venues providing happy times for people. It seems that the peaceful people of Indonesia are neither interested in violence, nor do they tolerate the Salafis' deviant way of thinking and their acts of killing. Indonesia is a country with 17,000 islands, with a beautiful nature. It acts as a bridge between Asia and Oceania. Centuries of colonization in the country have not diminished the Indonesians' love for Islam. This is Indonesia, the land of smiling Islam.
In the limelight.
The annual report vastly understates civilians killed by the U.S. military, and condolence payments are not offered even in confirmed cases, says Nick Terse, reporter, in an article published under the heading Pentagon Undercounts Civilian Casualties in New Report. Stay tuned for more. The U.S. military killed 23 civilians and injured another 10 in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Somalia during 2020, according to a Pentagon report on civilian casualties that was released recently and immediately faced charges of being a whitewash. Experts said the report vastly undercounts the dead and wounded from U.S. military operations, and they noted that the Pentagon failed to provide condolence payments, even in the handful of cases where it acknowledges causing death or injuries. The failure to accurately account and make amends for civilian harm does a disservice to civilians already suffering unimaginable loss, as well as to the Americans who deserve fuller transparency into the ways that U.S. operations have harmed civilians. Annie Shill, the senior advisor for U.S. policy and advocacy at the Center for Civilians in Conflict, toward The Intercept. She also notes an enormous discrepancy between DOD civilian casualty numbers and those published by civilian harm tracking organizations, human rights groups, the United Nations, and the media. Conservative accounting of civilians killed by the U.S. military in 2020, according to Air Wars, a UK-based airstrike monitoring group, is almost five times higher. 102 non-combatant deaths resulting from U.S. attacks in Afghanistan, Iraq, Somalia, Syria, and Yemen. And, as Chris Woods, the director of Air Wars, pointed out, the Pentagon's failure to pay out any compensation to affected civilians during 2020, despite several million dollars being available for that purpose, suggests a lack of interest in the devastating aftermath of those U.S. actions which go wrong. The Pentagon's dramatic undercount does not include any of the secret attacks carried out by the Central Intelligence Agency, which the U.S. government does not acknowledge. Nor does it take into account the civilian toll resulting from assistance to allies such as Saudi Arabia, whose bombing campaign has killed thousands of civilians in Yemen. The new report also notes that the Defense Department did not offer or make any such ex gratia payments during 2020. The reasons behind the lack of payments and whether any are pending remain opaque. Michael Howard, a Defense Department spokesperson, told Intercept that numerous factors can affect a commander decision to offer an ex gratia payment, and details on the number of payments planned or in progress are not available on short notice. Experts were vexed by the failure to provide payments. Congress has repeatedly authorized funding for ex gratia payments for civilian harm, and confoundingly, the DOD has repeatedly failed to make substantial use of those funds despite the large number of cases where the department has confirmed civilian casualties, said Civic Shield. This latest annual report covers U.S. military actions in Afghanistan, Iraq, Somalia, Syria, Yemen, as well as Nigeria, where a hostage rescue mission was conducted in 2020. It also adds to the Pentagon's official toll an additional 63 civilian deaths and 22 injuries during 2017 to 2019, mostly in Iraq and Syria. The Pentagon, Howard noted, continues to assess new reports concerning past operations after they are received and reconsiders previous assessments if new relevant information comes to light. Rather than deploying its sizable resources to conduct comprehensive investigations, experts said that the Pentagon appears to be outsourcing the legwork to human rights groups and journalists, and then only deeming a few cases credible. It appears many of the civilian casualties acknowledged in the report come from outside groups or sources asking the military to review its strikes or actions. Priyanka Mutapati of Columbia Law School's Human Rights Institute told The Intercept, adding, "We just don't see the signs that there is a serious effort to understand the full impact of U.S. military operations on civilians." The Pentagon report marks only the third time the U.S. has acknowledged killing or wounding civilians in Yemen. Last May, the Pentagon stated that it did not identify any civilian casualties resulting from U.S. military operations in Yemen in 2019. But the new Defense Department report now acknowledges the killing of one civilian in Al Baida Yemen on January 22, 2019. An investigation by the Yemen-based Mutuana for Human Rights, published earlier this year, revealed that an airstrike in Al Baiza on January 21 or 22, 2019, killed Saleh Ahmad Muhammad Al-Ghaisi, a 67-year-old farmer and painter who locals said had no terrorist affiliations. A witness told Mutuana that a drone conducted an airstrike on Saleh's car. "We are being killed in cold blood," said family members. The U.S. military has spent nearly 20 years killing people in Yemen, but still hasn't worked out how to properly investigate and ensure accountability, said Raida Mutawakkil, the chairperson of Mutuana for Human Rights, citing this new belated admission by the U.S. military shows how inadequate initial U.S. assessments of its own operations are. Its records cannot be trusted. Over 4 years, the Trump administration conducted at least 181 attacks in Yemen, nearly the same total as President Barack Obama carried out during 8 years in office. Attacks under Trump resulted in an estimated 76 to 154 civilians' death, according to Air Wars. The Defense Department, however, claims that as few as 13 civilians may have been killed or two wounded in three attacks during that same four-year span. U.S. Central Commander CENTCOM only acknowledged the January 2019 civilian death about 5 months after Mutuana presented evidence that Saleh Ahmad Muhammad Al-Ghaisi was a non-combatant. It's become a pattern. The Pentagon's previous Yemeni civilian casualty admissions, both stemming from attacks in 2017 under Trump, followed reporting by The Intercept of a massacre of Yemenis by Navy SEALs and an air wars investigation of an air strike that the Pentagon later said wounded two civilians. There is no evidence of CENTCOM ever having reported civilian harm from its actions in Yemen, unless first prompted by media or NGOs. That suggests, in our view, a lack of command prioritization on this vital issue, Wood said. Air Wars was shocked to learn, for example, that despite reported civilian harm having escalated sharply in Yemen under Donald Trump, no permanent civilian casualty assessment team was created to review such claims. Mutuana reported that Saleh Ahmad Muhammad Al-Ghaisi was his family's primary breadwinner, and his car, on which his relatives relied, cost thousands of dollars. Other families have also experienced financial hardship in the wake of attacks where the U.S. has admitted civilian casualties but offered no ex gratia payments, despite funds being available in the Pentagon's budget. It is astonishing that the U.S. military has acknowledged new reports of civilian death, but has not made a single payment to an affected civilian, or, as far as we know, any offer of assistance, said Mota Party of Human Rights Institute, adding, "Acknowledging errors is an important step, but those harmed are left to rebuild their lives and recover from losses with nothing."
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio.